friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, and on this fateful 20th anniversary of 9/11, we want to welcome indeed a very good friend of so many of us, indeed former Congressman Joe Crowley, who served as our congressman from 1999 to 2019. He was chairman of the powerful and very powerful indeed Queens County Democratic Party, and in Washington, the highest ranking New Yorker in the leadership as deputy whip. And so I want to welcome our friend and friend of so many, Congressman Joe Crowley. Joe, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you, Adrian. Always good to be with you.
You know, it's on this day each year we get to, you know, to commemorate and to look back with tremendous sadness, and I'm sure that you, with everybody else, will have no problem remembering where and you know, where you were at and how you got to know about the terror attack at 9/11. On 9/11, not just in New York, but let's say for New York City, where the majority of the firefighters and essential workers were indeed just wiped out. Where were you, Joe, on 9/11?
Well, it's interesting, you know, 20 years ago today, I was, I had missed votes that were scheduled for the Monday before on September 10th because the weather was so bad, they had canceled the flights out of LaGuardia. And so, was up bright and early the next morning, as we all remember, a sky blue, perfect day.
Yep.
And I found myself on the 8:30 shuttle, the Delta shuttle plane to Washington. We were a second from takeoff. We had this little plane in front of us, and I got a text. You know, this is the, you know, the ancient Blackberry, if you remember back then.
Yeah.
And it's from my chief of staff, and he said, you know, call me. And again, going way back, Adrian, when they had the phones in the seat in front of you,
yeah,
you know, because I couldn't use my cell phone, I took the phone, I dialed him up, and he said, you need to go off the plane. Two planes just hit the World Trade Center. And no sooner, and he said that, the captain came over the loudspeaker and said that, for some unknown reason, they shut down the entire airspace over North America, and it was taking us back to the terminal. And by the time we got back to the terminal, he came back to let us know that the towers had been attacked and that the Pentagon had also been attacked. So that was how I, you know, got first wind of what was happening that day, and that's where I was, LaGuardia Airport, on the tarmac.
Did you suspect at the time, or did the penny drop that, you know, your very famous cousin, John Moran, who was fire battalion chief, you know, that he would probably be a person that you would reach out to, that you would, you know, did... Could you imagine that your cousin, John, perhaps would have been in the area, or were you going to thinking of calling him and say what's going on?
You know, Adrian, the first thing that came to my mind when it came to my cousins really wasn't John. It was his brother, Michael. Mike was in a tree truck on 13th Street, just below Union Square. And I didn't know if he was on duty or off duty. I didn't know if John was working either that day. And so I put a call into Mike, and I couldn't get a hold of him. Unbeknownst to me, he had a couple of conversations with my cousin John that morning John was working. Mike was on vacation. But I always thought that Mike, you know, because he's a fireman and John was a battalion chief, I always thought the battalion chiefs, so they don't go into the fires. They don't actually do that stuff. You know, I didn't know anything about firefighting, you know. In fact, they do go in the buildings and they do a lot of heavy lifting work as well. But, you know, so my first concern was Michael, because I just thought he was, you know, being down in Lower Manhattan, that he'd be called in.
Yeah.
John said to Mike on the phone that day, this is all hands on deck. We need to be in. You know, John knew it was incredibly serious. It was what it came down to. He was just coming off duty that day, that morning. He was on Randall's Island in the Special Operations Command. It was known as SOC, for Special Operations Command. And Ray Downey was coming on, the famous Ray Downey, at the time was one of the most decorated firefighters at the time. And Ray said, John, we're going to need you. And John said, you got it. You know, got him for what they call a cab, which is, you know, those red trucks that go down with the fire trucks and ladders. And they were making their way down the Horn of Manhattan when they got held up in traffic. And what we know is John got out. He got into a cab and moved it out of the way and then got back into the fire cab. And it was asked to be let off at Tower 2. His last known words from the driver was, let me off here. I'm going to try and make a difference. And those are the last words we know what John had said that morning.
Let's talk about John Moran with a lot of genes coming from, of course, that would be from your mother's side of the family, right, Eileen?
Right, both sides. My mom, Eileen, her sister Peggy, married Walter Moran. And the Morans were from Leitrim. And the Murphys, my mom's side, were from Armagh. So not too far from each other, you know.
When was the?
John was well aware of that, though, too.
Yeah. When was the last time you had spent and his family and the Crowleys had spent with John Moran?
It actually was on September 8th. There was a block party on Beach 118th Street in Rockaway, where John and my Aunt Peggy and my clan lived. My grandparents lived on that block as well. My mom was married on that block, married off that block, actually, to my dad at St. Francis de Sales. So we have a very strong Rockaway connection, and we still do to this day. And it was a block party, we were playing music at it. You know, we played the Star of the County Down. We played a lot of Irish music and you know, rock and roll. John was a great musician. He was a bass player, but he played the guitar as well, played piano. He could sing as well. He was a great singer. It was really a hodgepodge of music that we would do, but inevitably we'd get around to the Irish music as well, and we had a great time that day. One of my great recollections of that day were going down to the beach, and John was a great kayaker. He was a great physical specimen. He was in great shape. And at the time, he was the youngest battalion chief in the fire department. So he was a graduate of Fordham Law School as well, and had a great intellect. And but he had taken us down to the beach and had the kayak, and we had the kids. And my little guy, Colin, who's now next May will graduate from the Naval Academy, was two years old at the time, in diapers. And we coming back from the beach, and John taking me to the backyard where we had a kiddie pool, and taking Colin and, you know, dipping him in the water to get the sand off his legs, and you know, gentle giant that he was. You know, he's this tough guy. He's a firefighter, great athlete, and yet he was handling Cullen with just his care. And that was on September 8th, and that was the last time I'd seen John, just a few days before 9/11.
Tell us a little about him. And there are some stories, you know, that surfaced around the time and definitely thereafter as to how he met his wife, Kim. And again, if we reflect on that time, here is this 6'2" fireman and a lady in distress walking just out of curiosity, walking up to him to find a place to eat. Bring us back to that.
Well, my understanding of it was that John was working at the time. It may have been around the time he was being transferred, before he was transferred to Rescue 1. He was working up on Broadway, on 44th and Broadway, at the firehouse there. It was like It was the firehouse for the stars, so to speak. But my understanding is, I don't know if I have the story 100% right. I just read about it recently, too. But, you know, Kim was, I think I've stood up, she asked if anyone at the firehouse knew of a good place to eat. And John responded, yeah, I know a great place to eat. I'll be taking you to dinner later tonight. And that was the beginning of their relationship, and it grew from there.
You, for most of us, we don't know what it's like on that day to have somebody. All of us would say, you know, we know somebody, we know of somebody. But again, as a family, now, you know, his mother, his siblings, all of that, the shock that caused, was there a sense of disbelief, even though it was now the worst we were experiencing the worst terror attack ever in the United States. What was that sense of, what do I say? What do I do? How do I embrace, you know, somebody, the family, and say, this actually is happening?
It was very difficult because we always wanted to hold out, you know, that John could somehow find a pocket somewhere.
All right.
And we're still struggling to stay alive. And, you know, it really, for so many families, you know, John is one of the people, the victims that we never recovered any of his body. And that also was, you know, difficult as well at the time to bring closure. But, you know, it was hard because we were all holding out hope that, you know, that some, by miracle, John would come out, you know, and as time went on, it was harder and harder. I was at a meeting with the city leadership, state leadership, with Governor Pataki and Mayor Giuliani at the time, and Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and the whole delegation. And I remember getting a note from Tom Van Essen, who was the fire commissioner at the time.
Yes, indeed.
And he just said, Joe, I think John is gone. The reports were getting back, and I had to excuse myself from the room. It was an awkward moment, but you know, my Aunt Peggy was, you know, she's tough. She was a tough woman, and you know, and stoic in many respects. But I think she was realistic about it as well. I think, you know, I don't know if it's a generational issue, but I just couldn't believe that John was gone. I just, you know.
Yeah.
He was more of a brother to me than a cousin, and we had been through so much together and traveled to Ireland and been all over the world with him, to France, and you know, we taught each other music, and we loved each other's company, and so it was hard to kind of think that he was no more, you know.
Now, tell us a little bit about that feeling that. You know, in growing up, particularly as a cop, as a fireman, as somebody there in the get-togethers, for those of us who didn't come from, you know, a family history of that public service, which brings with it, obviously, risks every single solitary day, tell us about the cops, the firemen, the politicians, the public service family from whence you come.
Yeah, it's interesting. It comes from both the Moran side and the Crowley side. Primarily, my dad was a New York City police officer, as was his my grandfather, his father before him, had gone to law school at night, became an attorney, along with his brother Walter, who was an attorney as well and was involved in politics. And so public service is a big part of my genetic makeup when I was growing up. And for John as well, not only the influence of my father, and I think was really a big reason as to why John went to law school that night at Fordham, it's because my dad had done that as well, and I think John was a great admirer of my father's. And John's father, Walter Moran, was also a Navy veteran, and he was also a veteran of the FDNY, the fire department. And in fact, John's uncle Charlie was highly decorated. His cousin Charlie Moran was one of the most decorated firefighters in the history of the FDNY. His first cousin Tommy Woods is amongst the most decorated firefighters as well in the history of the fire department. Tommy still lives down in Woods, down in Rockaway.
Mm-hmm.
He's a first cousin on John's other side. His mom was a Moran. You can see how this all gets to.
Yeah.
How connected we all are. But, so that was always, you know, I tell you, Adrian, though, in when John was growing up, you might have thought he'd be the last person to become a police officer or a firefighter. Just in so many ways, he was skinny, you know, and he had an aversion to healthy food. He loved Coca-Cola and he loved McDonald's hamburgers and French fries. I remember one time my Aunt Peggy said, I can't wait till he starts drinking beer. At least it'd be healthier than soda. And my father started laughing, so that's not true. But he knows, I know what you're saying. He actually one time, Adrian, when they were changing the formula to Coca-Cola, remember back then, he went to several Wall Bombs, and he would hide the regular Coca-Cola in places around the store until he can come up with the money to buy them.
Oh, my
God. But he was so desperately afraid that he wouldn't get the regular Coke. But that, you know, that was John. He just was that kind of way, you know, scheming and figuring. But a good fellow, a great guy.
Now, he had graduated from law school. Was there an expectation, or was he just thinking of perhaps retiring, you know, as a battalion chief in the fire department, mm-hmm. and continuing on, you know, in the field of law?
You know, I think what it gave to him was many options, a lot of options. I don't think he ever had any intention of retiring, per se, from the fire department. I've spoken to, have said that John would have been the commissioner someday. He just was, you know, that kind of a person and had those skills. So, you know, who knows what would have happened.
Well, would have,
it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. One of his close friends, Pat Tinlin, who was a deputy commissioner in the police department, they grew up together. And if you look at their lives and their paths, they're very, very similar. You know, Pat went on to go to law school. John went on to law school. They both rose to the ranks. And Pat stayed for a long time in the NYPD and left and came back. And he's back out again. I think John would have done something similar to that. I think he would have been, he was a lifer. As his, you know, his brother Mike just retired a couple of years ago from the fire department after 34 years. He felt it was important to stay for the next generation of firefighters to learn from people like him, you know. And he had a bit of his own moment of fame when he told Osama bin Laden to kiss his royal Irish ass at the concert for New York. I think many of your listeners remember Mike. You know, it was John's brother, and so I fell between Mike and John. Mike is a year younger than I am, and John was a couple of years older than I was, you know, so I was kind of the in-between kind of guy, you know.
Let's talk about then it's after the after 9/11, and how did you, and particularly in your powerful position in Congress, how did you come up with and become the sponsor of, you know, of what is now considered the highest award, you know, for, you know, for firemen, for cops, for those who have served and served so well and became, you know, the victim of their job, as it were,
right.
And their career. Because you did. I'm not too sure when, but a few years later, you authored that bill, the 9/11 Heroes Medal of Valor, which is which again, you know, is so appropriate, and so I think the you might tell us. You know, the process and how that how that came about.
Sure. Well, we had recently, just a year or so prior to 9/11, the federal government, through legislation, created the Medal of Valor. We had the Medal of Honor for the military to go above and beyond the call of duty and bravery. But we didn't have one for civil servants and for fire and police and rescue. And so... the Congress created that medal, and I thought it was appropriate that the first recipients of it should be the people that, you know, both in Pentagon and at the World Trade Center, you know, risked all. And there was some pushback, and looking back, probably correct in terms of that, but what was worked out with the White House and with Senator Warner from Virginia, Hillary Clinton was very much involved, as was Chuck Schumer on the Senate side. And I carried the ball on the House side to create the medal and to issue it to every person who died as a result of 9/11. And frankly, people who have died since then as a result of exposures to 9/11 or also qualify for that. It's important because it actually is a federal recognition that person died because of the attack that day.
Yeah, 442 public safety deaths were due to that to the attack, both in New York and in Washington. Now, there was not another initiation of yours was, you know, to create a fund a special fund for areas that are most obviously that are in the highest target areas. That didn't exist either, and if it did, it was kind of it was well hidden. Everybody said why. Didn't, you know, or most people would say, didn't everybody know it would be in New York? Didn't everybody know it would be Washington? No, everybody didn't know. But there was no special fund for those areas. And how has that worked in terms of having additional, you know, the additional fund there for situations that, like,
well, immediately after 9/11, there was an assessment that was being done, and I was part of that as well. But I worked very closely with then Jose Serrano from the Bronx in the House, an appropriator, as well as Nita Lowy, who was there. Chuck Schumer again and Hillary Clinton were very supportive, but working on the area, the Area Security Initiative. And what it really was to base funding two localities on risk assessment. So, for instance, New York, because you have such iconic buildings like the Empire State Building, like now the Freedom Tower, like Broadway, like Radio City, and we can think of so many things, the Brooklyn Bridge, the George Washington, all these iconic structures that that needs to be taken into consideration and evaluated when we're divvying up these monies, not just simply going to 50 states equally, because not every state is equal in terms of it being a target.
You're
so that
talking
was something
about,
that I was involved in.
The Urban Area Security Initiative, and that was one. Now, let me ask you, though, about, again, going back to the family. For most of us, you know, 9/11, again, we feel it. We feel it coming up. We feel it in the air. For immediate family members, how does that affect, you know, and for how long? You know, obviously people will say, well, you know, time heals. It would appear that in tragedies such as, you know, John Moran being killed on the day, time doesn't heal that one.
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. And I also think that people who are exposed to toxins and are dying as a result of those from the effects of 9/11, the attack of 9/11, that's also critically important here, that those individuals be given every respect and honor as we gave to those who died that day. Is very important to me. And that's why this ADROGA Act was so critically important, making sure these men and women have the health care, whether they're in the fire department, police department, or civilian life, that they need because of their exposure to those toxins as a result of the collapse of the buildings themselves. That was another thing that I was very proud to work with the entire delegation to see through. And like, this is done in a bipartisan spirit. Peter King was very much involved. Jerry Nadler, Carolyn Maloney, Hillary Clinton, as mentioned before, Chuck Schumer, and President Bush, President Obama, were also very, very much a part of that as well.
Yeah, if we go back to the, the recognition and the honor, the medals were actually presented by President
George Bush.
Yeah,
that's right.
And It's
I had a very good relationship with George Bush. In fact, when I see him still, and I'm going to see him later this month. Next month in October. I didn't agree with him on a lot of things, many things, but I will say that he was genuinely moved by the events of September 11th and what happened in New York, and that was something that always connected he and I, and I think always will.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned the now retired Congressman Peter King, that you work very closely with, and I think sometimes, and particularly in recent years, one would imagine that it's close to a mortal sin for somebody to cross the aisle and even be, semi-friendly with the member of the opposite party, whether that's Republican or Democratic. How do you feel that 9/11, in hindsight, that did bring, you know, the Crowleys and King, and then you'd have Bush, and we saw after that that there was a sense of humanity that was coming through that many would say wouldn't have otherwise existed.
Yeah, you know, as a matter of fact, Adrian, the plane that I was on that morning, September 11th, Peter King's wife was on that same plane with me. And, you know, we kind of rolled eyeballs at each other at the time. What's going on, you know? So I'll never forget that. But there's no question, I think it probably was the high watermark in terms of bipartisanship. And that's not even the proper word. I mean, parties went out the window at that moment. It was just about being Americans. And, you know, I wasn't there because I was stuck in New York. I couldn't get down to Washington that day, for obvious reasons. But the pictures of Democrats and Republicans on the steps of the Capitol singing God Bless America, it was just kind of, it was quaint, but it was moving at the same time. That for that moment, there was unity, complete unity. And, you know, these have been very, very difficult times for the lack of unity, the lack of ability to reach across the aisle. I myself may have paid a price for that politically, but I still think that it's the way the best legislation gets done is working across the island and at least trying to include people from both sides to develop a product. I think we need more of it, not less.
Yeah. And I think the most disheartening thing for most people is there's an expectation that's the way it is and forever will be because of the anger, because of the bitterness, because of, of the lunacy which now seems to be attached.
Mm-hmm.
Today is September 11th, and we won't delve into it, but this is a different day. And let's hope that, that tragedies like today, 20 years later, that should do something in terms of having all of us, get real and know that there are, better things in life and a responsibility from our leaders, to put everything else aside and see if we can do it. And we sure as hell haven't improved any in the last 20 years.
Well, I think we made some progress, but for every step forward, we may have taken a step or two back, too. And I think the events of January 6th were demonstrable of that, we have our own issues here at home that we need to address. And hopefully we'll be able to get through this.
Joe, thank you. And, to the Morans and to your family and to, all of the families, and close friends of those who perished on that day, 9/11, 20 years ago today. A prayer wouldn't go astray. And again, we look back with great fondness and memories, some of which are hard for any of us, but particularly for the families of those who perished. Joe, thank you. Thank you, and again.
Thank you, too.
Yes. Okay. And peace condolences
to you. Peace
at
to you.
This. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank
Joe, Joe Crowley, friends, they're bringing us some reflections of family and indeed his own role as a congressman who happened to be on his way to Washington and as we heard there was turned back. Fans are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.